give you all the rule suspensions you want. We're just killing you.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Wednesday, February 3rd, 2016. We're going to go out of order on the agenda today. The first, I'm going to open a hearing and have one testimony and then close it and move to the next one, but we'll come back to it. Open a hearing on House Bill 4142 and call Representative Gorsuch, please. In a summary, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 4142 is Representative Gorsuch's bill. Currently, unarmed private security professionals must have at least a high school diploma or a GED and pass a fast background check and do a 14-hour live classroom training. Now, this is different from a police officer, which has to undergo a 16-week training. So House Bill 4142 prohibits a private security professional, kind with 14 hours of training, from wearing a uniform or badge or driving a vehicle that would imply to a reasonable person that that was a police officer.
Okay, thank you. Please.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Representative Chris Gorsuch from House District 49 in East Multnomah County. So I'm here to testify, as was indicated, on House Bill 4142. This bill attempts to fix and update the Department of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training and their ability to correct situations where some security companies are using names that tend to mislead the public. Some of those include companies with names like that have names like police in them, CIA in capital letters, OSP in capital letters, things of that nature, which might lead people to think that those are full-on governmental law enforcement agencies. We do realize, after some conversation with some of the security folks, there is a concern about the overbroadness of the bill, and certainly there is no intention to say that security officers can't wear badges and that security officers can't have uniforms or security identification on their automobiles. The key thing for us here is to say that we want to create a bill that works for both DPSST and security companies by ensuring that they have clear guidelines on how they're to present themselves. And I believe that we can basically work together to create a bill that does not take away any sort of badges or uniforms, but clearly delineates when someone is a police officer and when someone is a security officer. And as many of you know, certainly the powers of a police officer are very different, including the ability to use probable cause, which is not something that is open for the use of security officers. So in conclusion, it should be a fairly simple bill, but of course, that's always dangerous to say. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I would love to answer any questions you may have.
Representative Barton. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gorsuch, thank you for bringing the bill forward. And it sounds like there's already discussions that you're working on. Thank you for doing that. Is there a particular situation or problem in your district or something that might have prompted you to bring this bill forward?
Not in my particular district. It actually turned out that my legislative aide and I were visiting some steelworkers in Albany, and as we were driving down the road to that location, we saw a company on the side of the road that called themselves Merchant Police, and we looked into that. I'm a former Portland police officer myself, along with Representative Barker, and so I immediately saw that word police and thought that was probably inappropriate for a non-governmental agency. And as we looked into it, we found that it is not clearly delineated in the Oregon Revised Statutes. So that's what led us to bring the bill forward.
Any further questions? Thank you, Chair.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have a good afternoon.
Call Larry Knight, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Larry Knight. I'm the owner of Nighthawk Protection. We're a private security firm working out of Oregon and Washington. The reason I'm here today is we just learned about the Bill 4142. When I started my company back in 2001, there was already language, I believe, under Oregon administrative rule to what wording could not be used. The words law, law enforcement, police, the state seal, and certain markings were not allowed. While I do support that, I do not believe a security company should use the word police. The way 4142 is, the three directives, no badge, no uniform, no cars, I'm sorry, got a problem with that. We're not clowns. We are first responders. We need to be identified, readily identified. Again, without the word police, security, protection, watch, something like that. So I just want to make sure that this is examined a little bit closer and not just approved the way it is.
Thank you. It is. We have amendments coming to clarify that because I mean, at first glance, it did look like
correct.
It wiped all that out. So
great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry.
I've got a question. Okay, do we have somebody else testifying? Maybe not of this gentleman.
Ms. Gorsuch.
And I apologize, I was testifying on some other bills. I was reading through this earlier, and I understand the concern the gentleman just brought up. I think it's talking, though, about the what is on the badge, the car, and the other piece there, whatever it was. What I did see some concern in is that it doesn't seem very specific. In what would be prohibited or not. So is there an amendment that will speak to that a little bit?
Representative Gorsuch, can you answer that?
I'm sorry, I was speaking
yes.
to the gentleman.
Do you want me to repeat that question?
Could you please?
It's not the first time I haven't been listening.
Normally, I listen with rapt attention.
Representative Springer.
Yeah, right. Mr. Chair, so when I read this bill earlier,
yes.
It's all about that one paragraph, which I get where you're going, and I join you in that endeavor. My concern is that it seems pretty ambiguous, and then based on the testimony I just heard, there is some specification in current statute,
right.
And so I just want to make sure those two things are going to go together, that we're not creating ambiguity.
Sure. And in fact,
do we have some amendments coming?
We do. As the chair mentioned, we have an amendment actually coming from the community college organization, the boards of that organization. And their concern was about the term, not, you know, the badge issue, the uniform issue, the car issue. That will hopefully be with us maybe within the day. Or two. But definitely the idea is to make it very specific to simply not being able to use a law enforcement term if you're a security person. So we do intend to clean up that ambiguity.
Thank you.
Yes.
I actually have one more question.
I'm sorry. Representative.
Thank you, Representative Gorsuch. Was there a specific instance that gave rise to you to do this bill?
Yeah, we were just talking about that with how we came across the bill with Representative Barton. Basically, driving down the road in Albany, and we passed a security company that was calling itself Merchant Police, and it seemed somewhat inappropriate. The other thing about that is it's not just you know, a semantics issue. It's also an issue of the power that security people have versus the power that police have. And we don't want anyone to have unreasonable expectations that they're dealing with the police when they're not. And so, especially with the issue of law enforcement officers being the only people who can act on probable cause, it seemed really important to clarify that. So that's where it came from. But as I was talking about in my testimony, my LA did some more research into the name issue and has found that there are some companies who have capital letters CIA or also OSP. And so that could also be something that would be misconstrued to be the state police, for instance, or a federal agency.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Actually, it's Valley Merchant Police.
Yes.
Out of Albany.
Yes.
They have been there since, they were there in 1987
mm-hmm.
as Valley Merchant Police. They've grown a lot. I think they have a great record. So I think we probably need to ask the question when the law came in effect to ban the words police and if there was a grandfather clause there. Well, I just think that that's something we need to be looking at. And I've not heard a complaint about them whatsoever.
No, and this is certainly not to pick on them. It's just how I came to the realization that some people were using that particular term. So no disparaging comments about Merchant Valley Police. There was a set of administrative rules that had been created by DPSST, and I believe that they're here with us, that defined all of this. And I think it was back...
Was it 06?
1999.
Oh, 99.
So the administrative rule was deemed unenforceable by DPSST, and so it was removed. But it was in place until 1999.
Representative Post? Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had to testify in another committee, so Representative Gorsuch, could you please start from the top again?
Oh, sure. So, once upon a time. Oh,
catch up. I'll watch it.
He doesn't always listen, though.
Representative Post or me?
I don't want to hear it.
Probably both.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, thank you.
No, all right. Thanks, everybody.
4142, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4123. Representative Frederick, and then Representative Carter.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. As mentioned, this is House Bill 4123, and it is brought to us today by Representative Frederick. We have not yet received the fiscal and revenue impact statements. House Bill 4123 directs the State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision to establish a community service exchange program. The program would allow individuals who have been incarcerated in a correctional facility and are on active parole or post-prison supervision to earn a waiver of delinquent fines and debts. House Bill 4123 details the requirements of this community service exchange program. This includes a condition that before a waiver is final, the person must remain conviction-free for 60 months. It also excludes restitution, support order obligations, compensatory fines, minimum felony and misdemeanor fines, and traffic fines from the program. Finally, it also provides that this community service exchange program is an alternative to the payment of attorney's fees, and there are currently no amendments.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm Lou Frederick, Representative of House District 43, North and Northeast Portland. I'm here to tell you about House Bill 4123 that I introduced after hearing stories of previously incarcerated individuals who are making an honest effort not only to get back on their own feet, but also to re-enter society as contributing members. It's probably not news to you that this is a daunting project, but one that we all have a stake in. Successful re-entry to law-abiding law-abiding life represents success for the individual and his or her own family, for the community, and for our system of dealing with unlawful behavior. Now, our popular perception of prison time is that it represents paying one's debt to society. However, there are a number of other debts that a person convicted of a crime might incur. Now, these include, for example, restitution to victims harmed by the crime. This bill isn't about that. Part of a successful reentry is acceptance of responsibility for harm done and an honest effort to make whole those who have been harmed. This bill is also not about fines imposed as part of sentencing. Many of our criminal statutes call for both prison time and fines as penalties payable to the state for crimes committed. Successful payment of these penalties is also part of an honest effort to get back on track. A person may also have debts that pile up due to inability to pay during incarceration, such as child support. This bill is not about that. I want to make that clear. This bill is not about restitution. It's not about fines imposed as part of sentencing, and it's not about things such as child support. My conversations with individuals struggling with reentry indicate that they understand their direct responsibilities to crime victims, to the state, to custodial parents, and are working to make those right. But there's one class of debt that surprises many of them: court and supervision fees. Fees may be imposed for court costs, for court-appointed representation, for some costs related to incarceration, for post-release supervision, and there may be other categories. These debts are in suspense during incarceration, but become due and begin accruing interest upon release. The collections clock begins ticking the day they are released. Now, I'm not talking about white-collar criminals here. I'm talking about folks who are individuals who come out without assets, without a job, often without a home. Within 30 days, he or she needs to either pay these debts in their entirety or commit to a payment plan. If they're unable to get, if they're able to get employment, they face wage garnishment. They may be referred to private collection firms, and many report contacts at all hours, which may not be a legal or ethical practice, but what are they going to do about it? As the hole gets deeper, the hope required to find and deal with the parts that they can deal with slips away. The hope of making it out of that hole may die. Prison may begin to not seem so bad after that kind of thing. So this bill is an attempt to make the light visible at the end of the tunnel. The goal is to create a way for individuals committed to successful reentry to pay this part of their debt in the currency they have, community service. This service would be supervised and meaningful. It would also be contingent on continuing to stay out of trouble. Under this bill, the debt would be reinstated upon additional conviction within 5 years, even if the service obligation had been completed. Now, in consultation with the Judicial Department, we were alerted to some details that need to be addressed before we move the bill along. They are working with LC on amendments right now, which should be available soon. My hope is that today you will hear the testimony of some individuals who have experienced this part of the system, and that we can bring amendments as soon as they are ready. Thank you very much.
Questions for Representative
Frederick?
Thank you.
Please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Margaret Carter, private citizen today. I am here as an educator and as a mom and a member of a community where there is a large contingency of our young people who are returning back to society, and before they can even get a job, they are back in the system simply because they can't afford to pay the fees that have mounted against them. And I think about 20 years ago, I brought something of this nature to the body before that to see if these people could be doing community service, and then the fees won't pile up. Not that the fees should be totally forgiven, but if they are doing community service, then whatever the pay is from that or whatever the requirement is for that, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, it just appeared to me that is a better way. You're not getting the money either way you go. And we are paying more money per day for them to be in jail for fees that we could let them do community service for, or suspend those fees, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, until such time that people have a job and can pay for that. But it just seems so, so hard and to understand why is it that we can let a person out of jail today, the fees start today, 2 weeks later they still don't have a job and the fees are doubling all along. I mean, it's like double jeopardy. And it just appeared to me that we need to have some sensibilities around this. We should not sanction them before they even get a chance to start their lives all over again. And I think, Mr. Chairman, I used to have you guys laughing at this all the time, but you must understand this. I want everybody that has breath and can work to have a job because I want my Social Security and my retirement. But we don't need to tie their hands before they even get a chance to get a job. And it just seemed to me some rational behavior should take place around this issue, and to hold them until they do get a job, I think community service is a way that that could happen. But at the skill center that the legislature helped me so long ago with, that we have these young people coming in, and when I know anything, they're gone again. And so the education is also limited at that particular point in time. So I hope you take a good look at this bill and realize the importance of being able to either help to rehabilitate citizens of our state so that they can get a job, or just make a decision that we're going to keep you in jail for a lifetime anyway. And so one way or the other, I think it behooves us as rational citizens to be able to figure this out in a way than it is at the present moment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I'm available.
Representative Post.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that. Representative Frederick, thank you. I, in everything that I've read so far, and I'm not the best at reading every little line, I like this idea a lot, but I just want to make sure I understand the part. Where does it start the accrual of this credit, so to speak? In other words, when the person's incarcerated, maybe they sign up for the program at that point, or is this after, completely after you're out.
This would,
does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And we, some of the details are still need to be worked out. But the idea is that when they are released, you begin to set up some kind of system. That can come before, just before they're released. But it can also come, and we have programs that would be more than willing to start that process. But right now, we definitely need to have it when they're released so that they have a sense of what they can do. Because a lot of folks, when they come out of prison, they do not know what's available to them and or what's challenging them. And you'll hear from several people here who came out of prison, and suddenly, 30 days later, they started getting these bills, and they had no idea what these bills even existed. Some of them had been accumulating over the time. So the idea is to do it in the best procedural way that we can so that they can take the best advantage of it.
The only thing I would just say, thank you for answering that. I like the idea of a person perhaps, I'm just going to make up a number. So this person's in for 5 years. And so on year four, they're able to hook up with the right organization, as you've described here. It seems like one more incentive also for changing, I guess, for lack of a better term, a way to get excited about, I'm going to be out in a year, and maybe I'm going to really move into this. I really like the concept, but starting earlier perhaps than after.
And we have some programs that are doing some of that right now. I'm talking with some of the people in the Corrections Institute, Correction System. They have other programs like that. We could certainly add that to it. The real key, though, the basic thing is we really, it is not punishment for life.
Yeah.
And we need to figure out how we start to address making sure that people are reentering their communities and doing it well.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Representative Post, I don't know whether that's in the bill or not. I don't know the technicalities of the bill. I'm here as an educator and a person who's experienced so many of these people coming out of the system with no choice. But I know one thing. If they had a five-year sentence and on the fourth year they had to be in touch with some kind of programmatic structure that gets them ready for the outside so they could have some kind of connection to a job and getting experience. One of the hardest things for us in North Northeast Portland, Mr. Chairman and Representative Post, is that we have had as many as 3 to 4 generations without jobs. So there's no training. And many of them don't know where to go to get a job as a result of no skill set. Yes, sir.
Yes, Representative Springer, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like the concept of this idea, and maybe these two concerns or questions I have will be addressed in amendments. First part I saw in the bill that caught my eye is it talks about an entity that is authorized to provide services to reduce recidivism. What does that mean? And how, I know what recidivism means, but what does that look like? What kind of organizations, I'm thinking of rural Oregon, if our folks in rural Oregon are going to have an opportunity at this because the program does or does not exist. And then how that gets, and I know it talked about the border parole and post-prison supervision, establishing some rules around that. What does that look like? How do you qualify? I would hate to see somebody that is a perfect candidate for this. Not everybody is going to be a good candidate for this. But somebody that's a good candidate for this, because there's no program, they can't volunteer at the some safe organization. I don't know about the Boys and Girls Club, but some organization that would be safe. But the organization
doesn't exist.
Authorized.
And we have a number of programs that are like that. Two things. One is the Department of Justice work that they're doing with LC is trying to speak to some of the official language regarding that. So that's part of it. That's part of the amendment process. But we have some programs like VOA. In Portland,
Volunteers of America.
We've had other programs that have done the same kind of that, and it is a question of what you have in rural Oregon. We really do need to find some programs that are going to be effective in rural Oregon, and it may be possible for some of the for there to be a regional kind of program that might work as well. But we have a number of things that bring some of the folks who are dealing with recidivism or trying to stop it actually that we've had that have been successful and bringing in things we've had.
Workforce
Investment Council. That's right, and Senator Carter has organized many of those particular programs over the years. So she could probably list a lot more, but there are some things there that can act as models. And so the question is, you know, whether we can get those together and how the Department of Justice might put those in particular parameters.
Additional question, please. Thank you for that. I would like to see that shored up because I'm thinking somebody in SIO, I don't know where they would be doing that without traveling 30 minutes or 45 minutes for a program. My next question is, and I'm not sure if it's in here or not, because I'm looking at the 60 months and those things. How many times can a person apply for this program? Because if the goal is to help them get on their feet and cut down on recidivism, then over and over and over is not a piece in that ultimate goal.
In this particular bill, you only get one chance on this.
Okay.
That's how this bill is written.
Tell me offline where that is, because
okay.
I never found it. I missed it.
Anybody else have a question?
I'm
sorry. Yes.
Please. Yeah. It's not so much a question, but last month, the U.S. Department of Labor came out with $5 million in grants to try to incent municipal, county, and regional correctional facilities to put workforce training within their correctional facilities to help with this transition. And I was thinking about it for Multnomah County. But I think this would be, you know, a great way to try to see how we can stack some of these programs to really make an impact on the people who are being released to give them a path to reentering society. So I'd love to work on that with you more, but I think that this is a really great idea.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Vedika Pisser, the thing I was talking with one of the people from Multnomah County facility, and just 2 weeks ago, and they told me some dollars had come in that area, and that they were going to give me a call to talk with me about that. But I think it would be a wonderful opportunity because the feds have not stepped in a great way like that before. It's basically been the state's responsibility. And as a matter of fact, the Skills Center at Portland Community College has been the only means in North Northeast Portland or in the city of Portland whereby we've been able to do skill development for people who are returning from the system. So that is a piece that is quite important. And may I say to all of you members of the committee, gang activity is not going to stop. I don't care where it is unless we can put young people into the job market. It's just not going to stop, folks. I mean, people, you know, one young man said to me, I don't care, Senator Carter, what you say. What you going to do, try to help with gang activities, unless you can help me with my little baby that's all dressed in red or blue or something of that nature to have some milk on the table, then I've got to do what I've got to do. And that's just how they said. And so it is a grand idea for us to try to stop the revolving door. Unless the revolving door is stopped, you and I are going to continue to pay high levels of dollars. And I'm sure some of the corrections people can tell you. But the last time I heard a number, which was years ago, was about $27,500 per year per person to help to be incarcerated. And I'm sure that number is higher than that today. And so I say to you, is it best to pay $1,300 a term for a person to have some kind of skill development so they can go to work or to continue to keep them in the prison system?
And, Senator, one of the things we've done in recent sessions is we've extended the release so people get out earlier to get their feet back on the ground in the community. And I know Director Peters, they're trying to get people started out before they leave the prison.
Right.
In good shape. So this will be a good addition. I appreciate Representative Frederick bringing it. It sounds a lot like Clean Slate, which we know the program, which has helped a lot of people get out of the downward spiral that they can't seem to get out of, the vortex of debt that piles up and piles up.
Exactly.
Mr. Chair, that and members of the committee, it is, for me, I watched that take place where we expected 300 folks to show up to help begin that, and we had 3,000. And it went from it went well into the evening, and just having people come up and talk with you. And it is a it's the kind of recovery that people have that makes a huge difference for them, for their families. You know, they're able to talk with their kids and say, "I'm going to be able to get these things done," makes a huge difference.
And all the zip codes did not come from North Northeast Portland.
Oh, that's right.
They did not. You, in North Northeast Portland proper, probably 97212, 211, 212, any of those numbers. We had zip codes from 97232 and 231, which means Lake Oswego, Oregon, and Beaverton, Oregon, that have been a part of this program. So please know we're not just talking about one central location of people who need help. We're just talking about people with these kind of background issues of the amalgamating of a lot of tickets and that kind of behavior, Mr. Chairman.
And if I can continue, Representative Springer, this is the kind of when we have this kind of a regional program, we really begin to speak to it. And being able to have folks from SIO be able to be part of some program would be really great. But we need to start it, try to find it.
Thank you very much. Appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
Call James Manning, Gail Meyer, and Bev Logan. And please go in any order you would like. Just remember to identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We'd like to thank the sponsors of this bill and retired Senator Margaret Carter for coming in here and championing this concept. It is true that our clients come out with so much heart and so much hope, and then it's really sad when it falls apart. There are the three things that really, really give the stability and foundation to someone for good transition back into society is housing, transportation, and access to treatment. That's it. But all three of those cost money. Housing costs money. Transportation costs money. Treatment costs money. And so when at the same time you're having your paycheck garnished because of these arrears in court costs and fees, it can just pull the rug out from underneath the foundation of what it is this person is attempting to do. So we love the bill. And I'm happy to hear that there's discussions underway for some practical logistical considerations. The bill addresses the idea of a conditional waiver once the community service is completed. But I'd like to at least broker the conversation if you could have a conditional hold on collection activity while that person is engaged in that community corrections or that community service, because that would be equally as important. So happy to know that there's going to be the opportunity to have that discussion. So thank you.
Okay. Well, good afternoon. Thank you for having me here. My name is James Manning from Eugene, Oregon. Today I come in the capacity as chair of the Oregon Commission on Black Affairs in support of House Bill 4123. House Bill 4123 makes a lot of sense. In addition to that, it builds upon Ban the Box. So it allows some type of relief as we reintegrate incarcerated Oregonians back to society by providing a pathway for them to learn job skills through volunteering in order to relieve some of those debts that they may have. So I think that is a very important approach. Representative Luke Fredericks stated more than clearly what this thing does not do, what it does not forgive. But I think that disproportionately, if we look at the incarceration rate, African-American and people of color are disproportionately represented in the criminal justice system. Therefore, their pathway may find it a little bit more difficult. This will be just a hand up, an opportunity to provide them with some type of relief as they transition and reintegrate back into society. And hopefully, the recidivism rate will dramatically drop. But it is very important that we continue to build upon Ban the Box. And I want to thank our legislators for that piece of legislation, because that was something that we will all see great benefits from in the future as we do today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Beverly Logan, and I'm a Portland leader with MACG, Metropolitan Alliance for Common Good. It's a broad-based organization of faith, labor, healthcare, and community nonprofits. We organize around key pressures on the families in our institutions. Phoenix Rising Transitions is a member institution of MACG, and their stories of exorbitant costs have moved our broad membership to strongly support House Bill 4123. Project Second Chance allows those reentering our communities from prison to perform community service to work off certain public debts. Without it, many are left with no viable way to succeed in society. Debts assessed by courts and public agencies compound or are sent to collections where they multiply over years of one sentence, while the inmate has no way to address, let alone pay, their debts. It's particularly egregious when public agencies aren't coordinated enough to identify and locate a person in prison to allow them the chance to avoid that disaster. Upon release from prison, many face debts that would be daunting for a secure working or middle-class family. It's well understood that those leaving prison have diminished chances of finding work at all, often, let alone work that pays a living wage. But they're expected to manage to pay off excessive public debts, as well as to pay restitution and child support, in addition to eking out a living, all on what is likely a low and utterly inadequate income. It's a setup for failure. If debts aren't paid, a driver's license can't be secured. Without that, the difficulty of finding and holding a job is multiplied. Without a legitimate income, in the face of continuing pressures to pay debts and support one's family, or just to survive, too many are left without legitimate options. I'm an adjunct sociology professor and well aware of the impact a prison conviction has on one's chances to succeed legitimately in society, despite best intentions and strong work ethics. And that was true before people started being assessed these additional fees after incarceration. After release, men and women face post-prison supervision fees in addition to court and other public fees that have compounded over years. Additionally, those who are mandated to regular sessions to address anger management, domestic violence issues, or are sex offenders, they're charged an additional $65 regularly, maybe weekly, and other offenders also might have to pay for recurring lie detector tests at $350 a shot. This dynamic isn't a setup for failure only for the individuals and their families. It's a setup for the state's failure as well. We'd like to see the comparative figures. We'd like to see the comparative figures for what the state is able to actually collect in fees from those who succeed in staying out of prison versus what it pays for those who, failing, return to prison. When they fail, not only does the rest of Oregon pay massive amounts to imprison them, but we pay for the children on welfare and in foster care because their parents can't adequately support them, and victims never receive restitution for their losses. Oregon fails its fiscal and social bottom lines. This bill doesn't ask that fees be waived, though the state might be better served if some were, but it asks simply that people be allowed to work them off, some of them, through community service. To close, this bill addresses just one small aspect of our criminal justice system. Too much of what passes as criminal justice is neither just nor humane, and the costs are staggering and self-perpetuating. As we spend more on prisons, more on recidivism, less is available for the very services that help people to succeed: education, housing, healthcare, social services, the things that would provide the stability and grounding anybody needs to succeed and contribute to society. The bill is not sufficient to correct our system, but it is necessary. It's a small but powerful step in rebalancing odds in favor of success for those directly affected and for Oregon itself. So we ask you to please give Project Second Chance a chance. And I just want to ask, is there room to say anything about suggested amendments? Am I allowed to do that, Chair Barker?
Yeah, you can.
Yeah, just very quickly. It's hard to see what we know about learning and how hard it is for those of us who are in very stable circumstances to change habits or to overcome difficulties. It is hard to see the value in requiring people who are under far greater stresses with far greater barriers to achieve perfectly. And if they don't achieve perfectly, to wipe out everything they've achieved to date. The one chance only is something else that I think you should consider, whether those two pieces are necessary to go forward with the good benefits that this bill would provide.
If you check with Representative Frederick's office, maybe they can.
Thank you kindly.
Be doing some amendments. Yeah. So.
Thank you for this chance to testify.
Thank you very much,
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Representative
Frederick. The bill would go to Ways and Means, and I wonder whether or not there is some way, either the committee or the chair or someone could write something up to go with it. And then I'm not certain in that process that they're going to have the time for an inquiry and hear what we've heard. So could you give that some thought with staff? And if anyone would want to sign on to a bill that stated possible benefits and the cost ratio benefits, it might help us.
We'll do that. Thank you. Good suggestion. Very good. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Michelle Brave.
No, you're right. A short session.
Nathan and Harry Olson, please. And you can go in any order again. Please identify yourself for the record.
So, Chairman Barker and committee, my name is Daniel Pulsifer.
You can go ahead.
Okay. I'm a recently released inmate. I got out November 17th. It's the first time in my life that I've gone the right path and tried to do something with myself. This morning is my first interview, and it was for Subway for $925 an hour. I already owe $1,800 on fees, and that was just from my past. Now I'm faced with paying more, and it's very overwhelming, and it's not for lack of trying. And so today I just come to you just to give my story for someone who has made mistakes in the past, who didn't have no goals in life and didn't believe in myself. Today I stand before you as a man who's trying to be somebody better than what I've been. And there's a lot of obstacles.
Speak into the mic a little.
Yes, and there's a lot of obstacles that I'm facing. And I understand what it's like to come home and face this. And it's overwhelming. And it's kind of scary because I've never held no job. I don't have no work history. I have no job skills. So I'm faced with all this already, plus owing more money with the threat of going to jail for not being able to find employment. So I just wanted to give you a face and let you see firsthand. Thank you for your time. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you for your testimony. It's important to see a real person. Sometimes it's easy to read stuff that doesn't address, but it's nice hearing from you.
Okay. Chair Barker and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Harry Olson. I am the founder of Phoenix Rising Transition and a leader in Metropolitan Alliance for Common Good, MACG, in Portland, Oregon. I'm also a certified peer recovery mentor. I'm here to urge your support of House Bill 4123. This bill will ease financial burdens of those who come for those coming out of prison and support their aim to make it in the community as successful law-abiding citizens. Just as an aside, we've been doing just what you were talking about earlier, going into the prison and working with people for a minimum of 6 months before they get out to help prepare them for this. And the MACG has a big hand in that. A lot of the people volunteer and come in, so they're intermingled with community members, which is something quite different than a lot of other programs. I direct the mentor project at Phoenix Rising Transitions. I've been working with people coming home from prison for almost 20 years. Before that, I was in and out of prison about half of the time for 15 years. I did about 8 years in prison. The last time I came home in 1991, I lived with my mom and two small boys, 8-year-old and 10-year-old. My mom gave me room and board, a bus pass, and $5 a week so that I can buy coffee and things. That was enough in those days. That was enough in 91. There were no parole fees, but over the years I've watched as court costs, supervision fees, class costs, and the interest accrued while incarcerated have grown and grown. These are often so steep that a person's dreams of carving a new life in the community seem impossible. And unfortunately, some give up and return to crime and prison because that's what they know. Others are able to persevere, but are in a constant state of anxiety about how to meet all the financial needs. The mentees I work with in Phoenix want to leave crime and prison behind. They are highly motivated, and most have done well at getting jobs. They are committed to paying what they owe, especially restitution to victims and child support. But people who have been in prison typically make 40% less than their peers. I'd like to share two stories of mentees who couldn't be here today because they're at work. This is Frank's story. I've been out for a little over a year, and I've been working since the day I came home. It's a good job, but I hardly make my bills. I'm being garnished for a past fine of over $5,000. My current address is on file at DMV, but somehow no one researched that fact. Instead, they sent notification to an address over 10 years old, and then, all of a sudden, I'm being garnished for 25% of my wages. That's about $600 per month, on top of $363 in back child support. Now that I'm already in garnishment, I'm told that there is no recourse. I don't mind paying debts, but how about a little less trauma to my finances here? Project Second Chance would help me just to make it in a somewhat comfortable fashion. It would at least make a life of crime seem a little less appealing. Thank you for your time. Now here's Gary's story. I work much more closely with Gary. I was released from prison on March 1st, 2013. Reentering society is challenging. One of my first welcome home messages was that I would have to pay $7,960 before I could get my driver's license back because somehow the county courts were unable to locate me while I was sent to prison. My $775 fine was sent to collections for 5 years. I had to work without being able to drive for well over a year to pay that off, all the while having to pay monthly supervision fees for the privilege of being on prison supervision, which at times prevented me from working on the north side of the Columbia River up in Washington. In 2 weeks, when I am released from post-prison supervision, I will have paid a total of $1,260 in supervision fees alone. I have also paid nearly $1,100 to Marion County and well over $10,000 to Lane County. In the calendar year 2016, I have already paid $1,327 to wrap up the last known fines owed to county courts. Any options for working off monies that may be available to prisoners coming out of prison are a good idea. Often prisoners are unable to pay the steep fines and fees required of them by courts and supervisory agencies. I know of far too many people who, in hopeless despair, turned again to crime and drugs and were again incarcerated at the expense of taxpayers. I am just one voice, but I implore decision makers to pass House Bill 4123 and approve alternatives to monetary payment of fines and fees. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Michelle Bracey. I'm a nursing student at OHSU in the baccalaureate program. So I don't know if I'll have much more to add from what's already been said, but I will tell you that the first time I ever learned about the criminal justice system was last summer when I took a class at Portland State University. And I learned about the focus was on women, incarcerated women. I learned their stories. I learned how a lot of them started into the system when they were young, children, teenagers. And then I also learned about the children and what happens to them when their parents are incarcerated. When I started this year at OHSU, I learned about Phoenix Rising Transitions, which is a reentry program that I'm working with, had the opportunity to work with this year. And so now I get to work with the gentlemen that are incarcerated, and I get to take classes with them at Columbia River Correctional Institute every Tuesday night. And I hear their stories. And I, as a nurse, I feel that my role is to have a voice and advocate for others. And I feel like when you're looking at the health of our communities, when people aren't given the opportunity, people who want to better their lives aren't given the opportunity, and there's all these barriers that they're faced when they come out of prison, I feel like it's our responsibility to do something about it. You know, I don't even know where to... as we've heard, when they get out of prison and they have all these fines that are accruing, there's that feeling of being overwhelmed. They often lack the social skills or the communication skills necessary to express what their needs are that need to be met. Thankfully, there are reentry transition programs that do, you know, at least welcome them to the communities when they get out and give them that opportunity. But we need more of that. And it's up to us to give them a second chance. And I fully support this. So I don't know what else I could say, but thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Any questions from the panel? Thank you, Pam, for your testimony today. Appreciate it. We're not able to move the bill today because of catching up to it. Is there anybody else who came to testify about this bill that didn't sign up?
Thank you.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4123 and open a public hearing on House Bill 4045.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, this is House Bill 4045, and it is brought to us today by Chair Barker. We have not yet received the fiscal impact statement. This bill does two things. First, it establishes a mandatory minimum sentence of 10 days incarceration for any person convicted of the misdemeanor crime of unlawful possession of a firearm. House Bill 4045 also mandates a minimum sentence of either 120 days or 300 days incarceration for a person convicted of felon in possession of a firearm, which is a felony. The 300-day sentence applies to a person who has previously served a sentence within the Department of Corrections. These sentences may also not be suspended and are in addition to any other sentence that may be imposed. There is also a -1 amendment, again brought to us by Chair Barker, and this amendment provides that the 300-day mandatory minimum sentence for the felon in possession of a firearm applies to a person not only who has served a sentence within the Department of Corrections, but who has served a sentence of over one continuous year in any other state or with the federal government, within the federal system.
I won't take the stand. This bill I introduced to have, and we may change the numbers on the actual amount of time. I've been concerned about people who have been in violation of gun laws, who had guns, and then who get probation because they don't have a bad enough history. So it's kind of a joke. And I've told somebody the story 40 years ago, around 40 years ago, when I was working as a police officer in Portland. Got a call on a suspicious car. I approached the car from the side. It was at night. I saw people in the car. Another officer was approaching from another direction. And a person in the car pulled the gun up, and I thought he was going to shoot the other officer. I drew my gun and was literally squeezing the trigger. A split
second away from killing that man, and I saw him let the gun go. And it was because it was a gun he wasn't supposed to have, but he just wanted to get rid of it. And fortunately, I didn't end up shooting him that night. And we went to court, and it was like a joke in the court, and it was probation. It's like no big deal. It's just a gun. So what? And as you may be able to hear in the emotion of my voice, 40 years later, I remember that event very well, and it was a serious thing. So what I want to do is just have a quick, sure sanction for people who have illegal guns and to try to get their attention. I'm hoping to discourage people from carrying guns. We had in Portland, they had over 600 shootings this year that fortunately there was very few people hit, but it's from young men who can't think more than a week ahead in their life that are carrying these guns, and they're an argument away from somebody dying, and that's what I'm hoping to prevent with this. So that's where this is coming from. I will call Chris Van Order, Kevin Sterrett up first.
Good afternoon. For the record, Kevin Sterrett, Oregon Firearms Federation. Chairman Barker, members of the committee, I fully understand the motivation behind this. And, of course, you know, as somebody who has been complaining for a couple of years about the inaction on the part of the police when we discover somebody making an attempted unlawful purchase, I believe people really need to be accountable. What worries me is because there is such a, you know, there's such an air of attacking gun owners or in this building in the last couple of years. This might affect people who you never intended to affect. An unlawful possession of a firearm now can be so easy for something as simple as having a key in a glove box, or perhaps a family goes to the range and then forgets to remove a gun from a car. The 16-year-old takes the car to go to Bible study, and there's a gun in the car. That's an unlawful possession. And to remove the discretion of the judge to be able to take in all those factors and put a person in jail when maybe there was really no real intent, no criminal intent. That's what worries me. As far as the felon thing is concerned, you may recall, Chairman Parker, a number of years ago in this committee, there was a discussion about people who had been charged with felonies and had them reduced to misdemeanors. Those people are still considered felons in the eyes of the court, and those people can still be considered felons in possession of a firearm, even though they have no idea that they're felons. And so to completely eliminate any discretion on the part of the judicial system kind of concerns me. And I, as I said, I don't want to see people misusing guns, obviously. But I do think that, you know, the whole idea of mandatory minimums has brought us a really ugly situation in Harney County right now. And it seems to me that maybe if the judges aren't doing the best job, maybe we can find better judges. But I would hate to see somebody who did something really inadvertent suddenly sitting in a jail cell just because of the behavior of some real criminals.
Okay, thank you.
Well, dear members of the House Judiciary Committee, Chair Barker, I really...
And identify yourself.
Oh, my name is Christine Van Order. And what popped out at me was the words mandatory minimum. I think that we need to move away from that completely in this state. I think that there's always going to be that one case, kind of like the Hammonds, that has everybody maybe taking a second look at mandatory minimums. So even though it's relatively short, I know that your intentions are definitely good, and I share whatever your goal is. I would love to help you, you know. I've got the same goals. My girlfriend just... has an apartment out at 181st and Division, and she hears gunshots all the time. But, you know, even though, you know, if it's like 300 days, I know a lot of felons. I'm a felon myself. I've been camping where it's like people start breaking out their firearms and want to go, you know, go shooting, and I'm like, I need to run. Like, I need to get out of here. I'm terrified. I always have nightmares of going back to prison for something, you know, so... But, you know, that the 300 days, I mean, if you understand, like, how bad the community, that's community time, you know, community corrections time, that's county stuff. You can't go stateside where there's more beds. And as you probably already know, a lot of the county jails are just, they're already busting at the seams, and people are getting turned loose left and right. So basically, I just oppose this because of the words mandatory minimum. And that's it.
Thank you very much. These are excellent points, and we're obviously not through the bill yet. So
yeah.
Chair Barker.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative.
If you go back, we did the big crime a couple of years ago. It was something 94, remember? But anyway, we talked a lot about the discretion of the district attorney to charge, and that got into plea bargaining. So the plea bargain might have to be taken and putting somebody in a worse jeopardy than if they'd actually gone to court and gone to a, you know, to a trial. So I've got some concerns about what this might mean to some people. And so I do hope that we can find something. You're on the right track, because I don't know how many thousand felons attempt to buy guns and they're basically not prosecuted. Well, we've got to stop that.
And I would also like you guys to all know that I'm working feverishly on trying to get alternative incarceration programs and expanding the number of close custody beds so that when something like this happens, and that guy you were talking about earlier, so when it happens, that there isn't someone just getting, you know, tossed out arbitrarily on the streets because there's no room. I mean, criminal justice reform is so necessary. You know, as our everybody's moving in here from out of state, from other countries, everything like that, we really do need to expand the number of close custody beds so that maybe later we can revisit the idea of mandatory minimums for something like this.
And the 300 days, was expecting to lower that quite a bit, too. So, I mean, but I'll take all these into consideration. We may or may not even be able to, we may or may not move the bill pretty quickly. Thank you very much for your testimony. Gail Meyer and Kimberly McCullough.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I have had an opportunity to talk to Chair Barker about the bill before session opened, and it was no surprise to him to hear that we would be opposing the bill. As a matter of policy, we agree with the prior speaker. We just think mandatory minimum sentences just miss the mark. It would be really great if this legislative body could put words on a page and then have those words translate to different behavior among human beings out in the street, but it doesn't really work that way. And Representative Barker, as you were mentioning, some of these people don't think about a week in front of them. That's as far as they go. And A, they don't think they'll get caught. And B, if they do, they think they'll get caught for something else other than this too. And so I just don't see this as being a deterrent. With respect to a court's ability to structure lengthy prison or, you know, custodial time, they have that authority now. Under the guidelines and under the misdemeanor sanctions. And so your first crime here, your unlawful possession of a firearm, that's a misdemeanor. It's common knowledge in the courthouse that a judge has a lot more sentencing discretion on a misdemeanor than they do on some C felonies because they're not tethered to the guidelines. And so the judge can throw an entire year at you and, you know, less than a day. And so the court could impose a stiff sanction if the court felt that that was the right thing to do. And similarly with the felon in possession of a weapon, if you go into the guidelines, the district attorney can allege aggravating circumstances, and then the court has the authority to double the guidelines, which it's a technical thing, but felon in possession of a weapon is a category 6. And so if you're at the low end of your criminal history score, those are presumptive probationary sentences. But if you have a prior felony, which you would if you're a felon in possession, depending on the felony and how many, you would be going to prison. So we would just we don't disagree that felons in possessions of firearms is an important thing to take a look at. We just do not believe that mandatory sanctions will change the behavior out there. And if a court really felt it was necessary to impose a lengthy prison time or jail time, the court has that authority now.
I would just point out, this doesn't prohibit the judge from putting a more severe sentence on it. And my concern was after talking to the judge in Multnomah County, which is, you know, that they said unless people have a pretty bad record, it's probation. And so I just would like, I want to catch people's attention without catching the 16-year-old gone away to Bible class with dad's gun in the car. I mean, I understand that, but that's the intent. So.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, this is Kimberly McCullough from the ACLU of Oregon, and I actually don't have very much to add to what Gail set out. We just generally, the ACLU of Oregon just generally has a general position against mandatory minimums. We like to give judges the discretion to be able to look at the facts and circumstances and determine really how necessary incarceration is for that particular individual. And so we do, again, very much understand the intent behind this, and hopefully the bill can be changed in such a way as to accomplish your goal, but without having to go the mandatory minimum route. So thank you.
Further questions? Okay, thank you. Close to the public hearing on House Bill 4045. And we will be meeting down in room 50 tomorrow.
Same time.
Okay. Bigger crowd.
Oh, yeah.
I thought so.
Room 50. Meeting adjourned. Thank you.